It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kay Darcher-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Last month after taking office, the Trump administration issued a freeze on public communications from federal health agencies, including the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC.
For decades, the CDC has issued a scientific report called the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report with important data and recommendations for local public health departments.
But that report wasn't published on its normal schedule after the inauguration, leaving local health departments out of the loop on major developments like the spread of avian flu. A new report came out on February 6th, but the content focusing on wildfire smoke and health was not what many public health experts had expected.
That is just one of many information sources that have been paused, taken offline, or edited in the last few weeks, and concerns from some federal health officials that Trump appointees are exerting undue political influence over public health communication.
What does it all mean here in Wisconsin? Dr. Patrick Remington is professor emeritus from the Department of Population Health Sciences at the UW-Madison. He serves on the editorial board of the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you tell us about this MMWR, Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, long-running publication from the CDC? What is it? What does it mean to public health departments?
Well, What it is in the name. It's a weekly report that the CDC has published for over six decades, where it mostly releases information about infectious disease outbreaks, but more recently, much more information generally about public health. It comes out weekly. In fact, when I was a college student and medical student here at UW, I used to get it for free. It was mailed to our apartment, and it's one of the reasons I became interested in public health, to see this information every week about outbreaks around the country, about investigations, about both routine things like influenza, but also unusual things like AIDS. When AIDS came out, we didn't know the cause of AIDS, and the MMWR was vital in sharing information about what we knew, what we didn't know, and getting to the root causes of that outbreak, and, you know, many, many infectious diseases since that time.
So a pause of at least a couple of weeks, and there are questions about the report that did come out. What does that mean if public health officials, doctors and others aren't seeing that report on a weekly basis?
Well, it's a great concern. I understand some of the policies of the current administration to really put a pause on information that's coming out, to check them for perhaps political concerns. But the MMWR is about as vital to public health practice as anything the CDC does. It's not just local and state health departments that rely on the information, but also practicing physicians. In fact, all of us, if a child gets an illness, a respiratory illness, and you're wondering what it might be, you visit your pediatrician. If he or she has seen a report in the MMWR about a certain type of pneumonia going around, walking pneumonia or mycoplasmal pneumonia, then you are better informed about that diagnosis. You know that this might not be a virus. It could be bacterial. Maybe I should do some more testing. Maybe antibiotics would be warranted. So it affects the treatment of illnesses with the information about what's happening in public health.
Now, just in the news over the last week, I'm seeing concerns about a measles outbreak in Texas, ongoing tuberculosis problem in Kansas, salmonella outbreak from imported pastries, and of course, ongoing worries, you know, when and how would avian flu show up in more people? Are those the sort of things that might show up in a report like this that would help those pediatricians and others watch for these emerging diseases and might show up in MMWR?
Well, absolutely. The purpose of public health is to take a 30,000-foot view of the health of populations. Clinicians and health practitioners treat patients one by one, but sometimes that bird's-eye view, you lose the perspective of what might be happening around you. A good example is a person got sick in September with a very serious disease, hemolytic uremic syndrome, and eventually 100 people were identified as being sick in 14 states. About a third of them were hospitalized, one died. And if we didn't have Public Health Surveillance and the MMWR, it published about 5 reports on that outbreak. That was determined to be caused by E. coli, a specific kind of E. coli that's very serious. And through epidemiology, discovered that fresh onions in McDonald's quarter pounders were responsible. That allowed the FDA, the state and local health departments to intervene, to remove food that may be contaminated, allowed individuals to make their own individual choices. So that's just a recent example of how vital this information is, but it may not be good for business. McDonald's stock took a dip. Profits were off because of loss of sales. So that's a great example where vital public health information is shared, but because of the outbreak, it may have political implications. It may have economic implications for businesses. And that dynamic tension between public health and politics sometimes plays out right in the pages of the MMWR.
We're talking about the Trump administration handling of public health information, a pause on CDC and other communications, what that means here in Wisconsin. Dr. Patrick Remington is with us, Professor Emeritus from UW-Madison, editorial board member of the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Looking at the CDC website now, there's a little heading. CDC's website is being modified to comply with President Trump's executive orders. And a lot of the explanation for the pause has been orders related to transgender identity, to gender. And some of the reports, some authors have said their publications have been held because they might be looking at risk of suicide or AIDS treatment, things like that. And there are specific statistics for people who are transgender in those reports. Is it important if people are out there identifying as transgender to include them in health statistics, or do we lose something if they're effectively erased from this kind of reporting?
Well, this may be the most visible issue, the concern about those words. And with this capacity of artificial intelligence to search not just headings, but entire text, you can find these words. And the administration is clearly concerned about the use of these terms in public health and public health practice. It doesn't make these issues go away. It's simply you're putting your head in the ground and ignoring the fact that risk of disease can be different depending on people's gender orientation. So risk of suicide is another good example where we need to understand what the epidemiology of public health problems are and learn as much as we can about society and about different groups in society. So, but those are clearly instructions that have been carried out. If you look on the internet, there are a number of papers that have been withdrawn, pulled back because of the use of these certain terms. My hope is that the fundamental practice of public health continues, that we get through this issue of concerns about terminology, and then we go back to the routine practice of public health where information is shared as soon as we know it to people who need that information in order to protect public health.
Dr. Remington, part of why we reached out to you, apart from your public health expertise, is you are an editorial board member for the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Do you get communications that the rest of us don't? Have there been explanations or anything like that going to you as a board member about why these changes, why these pauses?
Well, we've been talking as a board, one important thing is sometimes the information that comes out in the news is not entirely correct. Mm-hmm. You have to be very careful to check your sources and fact check. So right now, we think that the information is coming out from CDC as it is developed. So we're put on pause as far as reacting and going public with our concern. I think it's good to know that the information is back to coming out, that the MMWR is back to being a weekly report. But we have to be vigilant that the minute information is withheld that is vital to public health, that's a policy decision that's having effect on health across the nation. And just imagine if information about E. coli with concerns about the business implications were withheld, we could have had hundreds or thousands more people get sick, and some of those die because of political concerns. And that's just, to me, not acceptable.
In our last minute or so, Dr. Redmond, can you talk directly to people in Wisconsin who may not be healthcare providers, not in public health, and think, okay, this is just some bureaucratic wrangling in Washington? How could this impact people's daily lives?
Well, again, we don't often realize what goes on in state and local health departments or even in our doctor's offices. It's important that every individual who has a health concern see your physician and talk about the care that's needed, but realize that the care that's provided individually is informed by information about what's happening in the community. And that extends from influenza to foodborne outbreaks. And this is going on constantly in the background. Public health is not very visible. I think it's really important, though, that if information is being paused or withheld, that the public's health will be threatened. And so I just advocate for free and fair and open sharing of information, and don't let politics get in the way of public health.
Dr. Remington, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
Dr. Patrick Remington is a professor emeritus from the Department of Population Health Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He serves on the editorial board of the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. He joins us to talk about the Trump administration's freeze on communications from federal health agencies like the CDC, a pause, some things have gone back online, and how that all affects public health departments and, as we just heard, the treatment of patients here in Wisconsin.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, avian flu is hitting chickens and wild birds in the state. Find out why it's so devastating.
It is a very highly pathogenic virus that's in birds, too. Within a couple days, 24 hours, bird populations will die off if they get infected with this virus.
Plus, a look at the potential for avian flu infections hitting cows and people. That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As solar energy projects have expanded across Wisconsin, some in local communities have tried to stop large-scale solar farms from being built in rural areas.
As Joe Schultz reports, a new bill would require local governments to approve solar or wind projects before state regulators.
Bob Frazee walks through the rows and rows of solar panels at the Paris Solar Park in Kenosha County. He works for We Energies and gave a tour of the site last month. He says the park's 500,000 solar panels are programmed to track the sun.
And then as the day goes on, those panels will just keep moving. You come out here midday when the sun's kind of directly above us, those panels will be basically level.
The park came online in December. It produces enough energy to power around 55,000 homes annually. It's the first large-scale solar site in southeast Wisconsin, and environmental advocates say projects like this are an essential part of meeting Wisconsin's renewable energy goals. As more solar developments come online in Wisconsin, though, some of those projects are facing community opposition. Concerns can range from fears of losing rural landscapes to a distrust of developers and state regulators. Ron Taub lives in the town of Rome in Adams County. He's worried about a solar project that's been proposed on more than 2,000 acres in the town. He says people move to the area for its rural landscapes. He feels like locals haven't had enough input on the project.
I had to buy a $200 permit to put up a 10 by 15 shed on my property. Then you can put up 2,000 acres of solar panels, and oh, we have no control, it's private property.
Large utility-scale electric facilities, whether renewables or fossil fuel plants, must be approved by state regulators. They don't need local approval. State regulators have approved 30 solar projects over the last decade. State Representative Travis Tranel is a Republican from Southwest Wisconsin. He's one of the authors on a bill that would require local governments to approve solar or wind projects that are more than 15 megawatts before they can be approved by state regulators. He said the State Public Service Commission's approval process feels like just a box that needs to be checked.
I am certainly not anti-renewable energy, but what we are doing is going to have a lasting and dramatic impact on what rural Wisconsin looks like.
In a statement, the Public Service Commission said regulators are required by law to apply the same level of scrutiny to renewables as they would for a new fossil fuel plant. The agency says it has an extensive, months-long process for approving projects. The state regulator estimates that approved solar projects account for less than 1% of agricultural land in the state.
The norm is that farmers decide what they do on their property. We don't typically ask community leaders to vote on what farmers are doing in other contexts.
That's Chelsea Chandler. She runs an organic fruit and vegetable farm in Lafayette County and also works for the nonprofit Clean Wisconsin. She says the bill requiring local approval would slow the clean energy transition.
This is sort of a novel idea that's being proposed for solar and wind specifically.
One farmer who chose to use his land for a solar development is Ed Howell of Union Grove. He's leasing more than 100 acres to the Paris Solar Park. He was approached by a developer a few years ago about leasing his land for the solar project.
We ran him off a few times and he kept coming back, and then we kind of researched some stuff.
After speaking with developers on and off for more than a year, Howell finally signed a contract to lease his property.
Everybody's story is different, but a lot of guys were our age or older looking for retirement, you know, and nobody ever got rich farming around here, so instead of selling it and moving to town, you could still retain ownership and still stay here.
Howell admits it was sad seeing the panels go in on land he's worked for decades, but overall he's satisfied with the arrangement, saying it will help him pass the farm along to the next generation someday. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
As of last week, there have been 67 confirmed cases of H5N1 avian flu in humans and one death around the country. There's also been at least one case in Wisconsin when a poultry farm worker in Barron County caught the illness.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report that more than 150 million birds nationally have been infected or killed by the virus. The epidemic is causing egg shortages at supermarkets and restaurants around the country and aggravating inflation.
So far, the outbreak hasn't sparked a human epidemic, but doctors worry about that possibility. To learn more about the avian flu epidemic, what it means for farmers and others in Wisconsin, we turn to Dr. Peter Halfman. He's an assistant professor at UW-Madison's Department of Pathobiological Sciences in the School of Veterinary Medicine. Peter, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
People are probably most familiar with the impact of avian flu when it comes to the egg prices, the signs they're seeing in grocery stores now. What is it about this virus that has been so quick to spread and so lethal for chickens?
Influenza viruses replicate in humans and the respiratory tract, and this do the same thing in birds, but also in birds they replicate in the GI tract, so the intestinal tract. And if you've ever parked under a tree in summer here, you can see how messy birds are, and that virus is being expelled in high quantities in bird droppings and can spread really quickly in birds. And it is a very highly pathogenic virus that's in birds too. Within a couple days, 24 hours, bird populations will die off if they get infected with this virus.
Is it normal for an avian influenza to spread amongst so many different kinds of birds? I look at reporting and we're seeing eagles, mallards, ducks, swans, a wide variety, not just our domestic poultry. Do avian influenza spread among different bird species so commonly? It seems like it's a heavier lift, at least for viruses, going from different mammal species to one another.
That's right. From birds to mammals, it's more difficult, but within bird species, it's fairly relatively easy to transmit. You can imagine you have these shorebirds, ducks, geese, bird droppings are in the water, bird droppings full of virus. So the virus can get spread fairly easy with droppings between all different bird species. And then you have the raptors that are picking up dead mammals that have the virus in them and becoming infected that way.
Given that we live in a world where wild birds kind of go wherever they want, what kind of precautions can those larger operations in particular take?
No, you're exactly right. It is difficult to get this virus under control, and it's obvious. We've lost 150 million birds just in the United States within the last couple of years since the virus came in. The federal government is suggesting for vehicles that come onto farms, wash that vehicle down so you don't spread the virus from farm to farm. People working on those farms should have dedicated clothes that don't ever leave the farm facility, so you're not transporting the virus from one farm to another, especially if you're in the veterinary world. If you're going farm to farm checking on birds, you could potentially be transferring this virus farm to farm all the time.
And when people think Wisconsin and livestock, they think cows, of course. But I looked at the latest census of agriculture, something on the order of 16 plus million chickens in Wisconsin, counting layers, ones grown for meat and some others. This is a significant issue. Even if we weren't worried about mammals, the impact on chickens is a big deal for Wisconsin, right?
That's correct. And, you know, northern Wisconsin had two outbreaks recently, and that was the cause of the first human case in Wisconsin, was a poultry worker becoming infected from an infected flock.
Getting back to advice, we have a lot of people in the state with backyard chickens, and we might be talking, you know, one to maybe low two digits numbers. Advice for them, they might think, well, we're not on a big operation where it's going to spread among a bunch of different animals. They need to be thinking about this too, right?
That's right. I have a sister-in-law who has about a dozen hens, and I've given her advice too, especially after the gentleman in Louisiana who had a backyard flock became infected, and he actually passed away because of the virus.
We're going to get to our mammals in just a minute, but for birds in particular, what kind of monitoring do we have, and what kind of monitoring do we need?
So once the virus gets into the flock, it's very easy to recognize what's going to happen next. Again, the virus is extremely deadly, so you're going to notice your birds becoming sick right away, and you're going to find sick and dead birds in your backyard within a couple days. Contact your local USDA, contact the DNR here in Wisconsin, report that you do have sick birds, and they'll kind of send someone out for testing and get back to you of what is causing that disease in your birds.
Is there any hope of either a vaccine that we could use for livestock or a treatment, an antiviral, I guess, treatment that might be effective?
So antivirals are typically outlawed for poultry farms, mainly because of the ability for this virus to adapt and then become drug resistant. So we would lose our antiviral drug ability in the human population. There is a big push for vaccines, but just like in the human population, every year people are getting a seasonal vaccine because this virus mutates so fast. So it'd be really hard to try to keep up with the changes in the virus with the different vaccines and what the cost would be for that.
We're talking about the ongoing avian flu epidemic affecting chickens, wild birds in the United States. Peter Haffman is an assistant professor at UW-Madison's Department of Pathobiological Sciences in the School of Veterinary Medicine. Peter, let's turn to mammals now. There's been concern about this virus showing up in cows, dairy cows in particular, I believe, not clearly as lethal or quick to spread among our dairy cows. What do we know right now?
Well, luckily in Wisconsin, as far as we know, the herds are free, but we currently have had close to 1,000 dairy herds in 16 different states contract the virus. And what people have noticed when it gets into a dairy farm is that milk production just plummets in these cows. And that's a huge economic loss to dairy farmers once the virus is established in their dairy herds.
the last time I talked to someone about this, one of the key factors people were pointing toward was shared milking machines. You know, you milk one cow in this machine, you milk another one, and that might be a point of transmission. Is that still one of the main points of potential concern?
That is, but experimentally, we can't repeat that in the in the research field. So there are a lot of questions out there how this virus is being transmitted from dairy herd to the next dairy herd. And then just this week, another introduction of a different type of bird flu was introduced from birds to cows in Nevada. So we thought this was a one-off last year around this time, but we see now birds can be introducing this virus possibly multiple times to dairy herds.
Cows not the only mammals showing up with this. Some wild animals, and then I've seen some reports of cats dying of this avian flu. What is going on? How is that getting transmitted to maybe a pet cat?
First off, there's the raw milk. Raw milk from an infected cow is full of virus. So on farms, letting the cat lick up the milk that's on the floor, the parlor floor, is not a good thing to do. In LA County, there was raw milk that was for sale for human consumption. It was tainted with virus. The pet owners fed it to their cats and they became infected too. The other issue is unintentional raw meat. Some cat food is made with raw turkey. Turkeys become infected with H5N1 bird flu. Since it's raw meat, the virus is still alive and cats have become infected with raw food.
So do you have advice for pet owners avoiding raw food potentially? Other thoughts if people want to make sure their pets, their cats in this case, don't contract this?
Yeah, I would not feed my cat any kind of raw turkey, raw chicken food. I would make sure it's not a raw. And then just don't consume raw milk. Don't let your cats consume raw milk either.
Transmission human seems pretty rare, and with one exception, I think just one fatality that we know of so far. What is the state of potential transmission to humans right now?
We've seen 67 human cases so far, and like you said, it is a one-off. It is from the animal to human, and then there is no human-to-human transmission right now, which is a good thing. The one concern, again, is the virus likes to mutate. There was a case in British Columbia, Canada, where a teenager became infected. It was a long infection over 2 weeks. And what scientists noticed that the virus has started to mutate to like the human host a lot better. So we know some mutations, and these mutations make the virus replicate better in humans. And we can see those mutations occur in this British Columbia case. So that's what we're kind of watching out for. Also, on the bird flu virus goes from birds to other mammalian species, it wants to adapt. And all of this transmission within cows, birds to cats, birds to cows, we're just making the virus want to mutate more. So that's what we're watching out for. And that's what the surveillance program now is in the United States. Anyone that gets an influenza infection, it gets sequenced right away. And we can tell definitively then if it's H5N1, or if it's just a regular seasonal virus.
A question that occurs to a lot of people, I think, is, well, we eat eggs, we eat chickens, and we drink milk. Are there risks of transmitting this disease by consuming these animal products?
If it's well cooked, if it's pasteurized milk, there is no concern. We're not seeing that happen. Like I mentioned with the cats in the raw milk, it does happen in mammalian species like cats. We have not had a case of humans becoming infected by drinking raw milk. But if it can happen in cats, can happen in the lab, I would advise not drinking raw milk.
In the presidential administration transmission, there have been some CDC websites and reports that have been taken down briefly, temporarily, or ongoing. Have you, in dealing with this avian flu, run into any issues with information sharing?
Funny you should mention it. Today, we did hear that a news article was taken down. It was concerning the transmission of bird flu between cats and humans. We just heard about it. We don't know what the information is, but if this virus does transmit from birds to cats and then cats to humans or vice versa. We really should know about that, and so should the public. Also, the you know, how many herds are infected, how many birds have been depopulated because of this virus. Those statistics would be great to know, and what states have dairy cows that are infected. All that information should really be out in the public, and I hope that continues with the USDA and other organizations. It is really great information to have.
And of course, viruses don't respect international borders, neither do birds for that matter. How important is international cooperation and the flow of information from one country to another in tracking these diseases, potential mutations over the next coming months or years?
Well, that's how we got here. I mean, this was a virus 20 years ago that was in Southeast Asia only. And it has, with birds that migrate, has migrated all around the world with the birds. And the other issue is when birds from North America start to migrate to South America, these bird viruses can then transmit to sea mammals and cause massive die-offs and massive continuous replication in these sea mammals. So we should be watching what kind of mutations happen in sea mammals, just so we know that none of these mutations could affect humans.
Peter, thanks again for joining us today.
All right. Again, thanks for having me. Appreciate talking about this.
Peter Halfman is an assistant professor at UW-Madison's Department of Pathobiological Sciences in the School of Veterinary Medicine. He talked to us about the latest in the ongoing avian flu outbreak. If there are any people out there listening with backyard chickens or have chicken farms, love to hear from you, your experience, what kind of precautions you're taking as you hear this news. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a new classical album is inspired by the Wisconsin landscape.
My piano compositions are very dynamic. They like to move, and they like to go somewhere. They like to take a journey.
It's the debut album called When We Were Bears. That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A debut album by a Milwaukee pianist and composer is inspired by the Wisconsin landscape and the people she holds dear.
But starting out, like many seven-year-olds sitting at the piano, Alicia Retleski's parents would set the oven timer so she would get in her 30 minutes of practice.
And if they didn't hear any music, they'd yell from the kitchen, "I don't hear anything." And I would then resume my practice.
In high school, Retleski started to get serious about her music. She was inspired by her new piano teacher and went on to earn a music performance degree from Ripon College.
Alicia Retleski's debut album is called When We Were Bears. She composed the pieces over 8 years, and they started to take shape in 2016 when she was an artist in residence at a farm in Campbellsport.
There's something about being on a farm that feeds your spirit and your soul. Digging in the dirt and pulling weeds and harvesting vegetables, being out in nature for hours a day, that starts to really clear your mind in such a lovely way. And I was working with the most amazing people on the farm too, and that helped a great deal as well. But I did feel like I had a lot of space, and I felt like I had permission almost to hone in and really start to see myself in this way as a composer.
Let's listen to a bit of the Three Sisters Farm Suite. This is the second movement called The Farmers. ¶¶ I'm trying to imagine you out on this expansive landscape on a farm. Maybe there are animals around. What can I pick up on in that piece?
Yeah, that one's the farmers. And to me, farmers are this combination of, what's the word I want to use? They're so efficient. Hmm. They're so quick and also accurate in their work. But they also really know how to take a break. There's this, in that piece, I specifically hear them hurrying, but gracefully through all of their enormous amount of work they have to do. That's what I had in mind.
And the chord progressions really lead me somewhere. Like as I listen, I hear movement and I hear activity and I hear busyness, but in such a fluid, very controlled and, you know, I guess just predictable in some respects way. How would you describe your piano compositions?
My piano compositions are very dynamic. They like to move, mm-hmm. and they like to go somewhere. They like to take a journey. And I also think they like to create a space. And when I'm composing and listening for the next part to add to my piece, I'm really listening for all of these specific things. But I think space is a big one for me. Hmm.
We're talking with classical pianist and composer Alicia Ritleski about her debut album. It's called When We Were Bears. When We Were Bears, the title track of the album, from what I understand, that you had really been inspired by a friend who had such a profound connection to you. How do you express that through these different compositions and through this title track?
Yeah. So the When We Were Bears song, like you said, it's about this friend that I met here in Milwaukee, and I realized we sort of came from similar backgrounds, and I felt an instant connection with her. And the song is specifically about reincarnation, or thinking about being connected to different people at different lifetimes, and that life is infinite in that way. We have all these intimate connections with people that sometimes transcends maybe just some common acquaintance or something like that. But I think that idea sort of pervades the album, and that the album is about connection. It's about people who inspire you and make you feel, connected to something much bigger than yourself.
But people change, they evolve, your relationships change with the people who are the inspiration in some of these pieces. Does the permanence of the music at all impact you, or do you feel fully finished with these songs once they're done?
That makes me think of Jonathan Richmond. He has this, the musician, he has this idea that music evolves over time. And so he even changes his lyrics sometimes over time to reflect that in his music. And my music does stay a little more the same. But I think the way I play the pieces feels so different now than how I used to play them. I had actually listened back to one of the first times I ever played The Farmers, and it sounded so different to me. And I thought, oh my gosh, it really has changed quite a bit, even though it's the same piece. So I think too, the pieces still, even in their very specific selves, also evolve in the way that I play them.
You have one piece titled Ephraim, the village in Door County with that coastal, scenic charm of Lake Michigan. It's the name of a song here on your album. Let's take a listen. What season is this in Door County?
I think it's August. I think I wrote it in August, or for an August wedding specifically. It was for my aunt and uncle's wedding in Ephraim. I don't know if you know the specific spot, but the photo is on the single release on my playlist. And it has the photo of that graffitied gallery, art gallery, that's out, like it's jutting out into the lake, and that's where they had their wedding. And so I sometimes picture that little gallery there. It's really magical, that little spot.
What is your writing process like?
I like to listen for the music to come to me, I guess. Mm-hmm. When I'm sitting down at first, I sort of play around with sounds and ideas, and I'm starting sort of grasping at what do I like, what is capturing me at that moment. And then as I'm writing the piece, yeah, I sort of, instead of thinking, I sort of feel and I listen for the next part to come to me. And then if I hear it but I can't play it, I go, was that it? Was that it? And I play around till I can capture that next part that connects to it. And sometimes as I'm working on it, it doesn't go linearly. Sometimes I hear a part, but it doesn't connect to the first part. So I record all these different pieces and then I connect them as I go. And so once I'm finished, it's all, I make a full recording of it. Mm. And then after that, I will score the piece as well.
I was wondering, are you scribbling down notes as you go, or is there software for that?
So I don't write anything down until it's finished. I just record it in pieces until it's, and then I fully record it, and then I write it down, and I put it into, it's called Sibelius, and it's a music writing program, and I can hook up my keyboard to my computer and play some of the parts into the keyboard, and it goes into the program. It's tricky. You still have to do it all by hand. And it's well worth it in the end.
Let's hear Free Spirit. And I understand this is dedicated to your friend Mel. Is there something in particular you were thinking about when you wrote Free Spirit?
Yeah, I like to give myself some parameters as I start to write a piece, and because it gives focus to the piece, and I like to focus my pieces on people sometimes. And so, yeah, my friend Melinda was the focus for that piece, and I wanted to represent her personality musically, and I do see her as this, she'd love to travel and try new things and live cool places. And sometimes I got to visit her in these different places. I wanted to represent that musically.
You also have made your music available as sheet music. Is that coming from a place, you as a piano teacher?
Yeah, I like to play music. And I was looking, I like to find different pieces to play, sometimes for myself. Sometimes I used to work for churches and I would play these different pieces as well that I found. And so I was always looking for new music and I couldn't get enough. I was looking for this specific genre of like the Ludovico Einaudi music, very like classical crossover stuff, like Idas Evensen and Jan Tiersen. I was looking for all of those types of composers and music and I couldn't get enough. I couldn't find enough of it. And so I thought I need to write my own pieces as well. And scoring them was a big part of this process because I wanted to be able to give it to other pianists as well so they could play the pieces.
I wonder how you got this album to the finish line, knowing that how to do the recording sessions and the mixing and the mastering and the all the behind the scenes part of an album that we aren't really privy to as we listen to your album.
Yeah, that was a giant learning curve for me. I didn't really know anything going into this process. And I'm pretty lucky that I was able to reach out to some music friends here in Milwaukee, and they helped me along the process. And so you sort of take one step and then maybe something goes right, something goes wrong, and you have to pivot. And so it was this, I felt like I was learning and pivoting, and it was a lot. But yeah, it's been very rewarding.
What do you hope that we take away from When We Were Bears?
I think for me, music is about processing and also feeling a space. And I know that sounds a little bit odd, but music puts me in a place. And I wanted to share that feeling with other people of feeling like you can feel at peace with yourself in a moment, or enjoy the bird songs a little more because you're listening to this piano track. And also maybe it helps you process some emotion or just feel in the moment at that moment.
Alicia, thank you for sharing your music with us.
Thank you so much for listening.
Alicia Retlesky is a classical pianist and composer in Milwaukee. Her album is called When We Were Bears. Her debut performance of the album was at the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee. And we're going out on Movement 3 of the Three Sisters Farm Suite called Soil Fertility. Just heard fresh new music from a Wisconsin composer and pianist.
And now we'd love to hear what you're listening to. Is there new music you want to spotlight from a Wisconsin artist or band? How did you first encounter them? What do you appreciate about their work and how the music makes you feel? Is there a singer or songwriter from Wisconsin you want to recognize?
Tell us about the music coming from our state that you want other people to check out. Maybe we can incorporate your shout out in a future program. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. That number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.